Hello, you are listening to the Human Rights 2020s podcast, brought to you by the Human Rights Consortium Scotland. This episode is a recording from an event entitled Human Rights Leadership, Priorities and Concerns for Scotland, which was held on the 15th of June 2022. The keynote speech was delivered by Murray Hunt, the director of the Bingham Centre for the Rule of Law. The event was chaired by Naomi McAuliffe, Programme Director of Amnesty International in Scotland.
Hello, welcome everyone. My name's Naomi McAuliffe. I'm head of Amnesty International's Scotland office and welcoming you here today to the Human Rights Consortium Scotland event on human rights leadership, priorities and concerns for Scotland. This is quite an auspicious day for us to be holding this meeting. I'm sure lots of you heard last night or woke up this morning to the news that the European Court of Human Rights stopped the flight to Rwanda of asylum seekers. And unfortunately, today we have seen now quite a few MPs and ministers coming out and questioning our involvement in the European Convention of Human Rights. So it's very timely that we should be talking about this, that we should be coordinating and mobilising because there's lots of threats on the horizon. So with that in mind, I'm going to hand over to our first keynote speaker. We are going to be hearing from Murray Hunt, who is director of the Bingham Centre for the Rule of Law and a former advisor to the Westminster Joint Committee on Human Rights, has also been a former member of the National Task Force on Human Rights Leadership, and he will be sharing his perspective on Scotland's human rights. So can I hand over to you, Murray? Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed, Naomi, and good morning, everybody. Thank you to Vari and the Human Rights Consortium for inviting me to speak to you and to be with you all this morning, which I'm absolutely delighted to do. As Naomi said, I'm going to be providing an outsider's perspective on Scotland's human rights leadership. I'm sitting in London as I speak to you, and as Naomi said, things look rather different from down here. I walked past on my way into the office a newsstand with virtually every front page raging about the role of the European Court of Human Rights following yesterday's interim measures. So one of my perspectives is going to be the view from London on Scotland's human rights leadership. And I'm also going to briefly look at what it looks like as well from a European perspective and also globally. So the view from the UN and the rest of the world, very, very briefly. The first thing I wanted to do, you'll see that the date there is significant for the Bingham Centre for the Rule of Law. I wanted to wish you all a happy Magna Carta Day. Now, I realise that Magna Carta doesn't have an awful lot of resonance in Scotland, although it certainly has its sort of parallel in the claim of right, I suppose. But it's quite interesting that today is not universally seen as Magna Carta Day, because in its time, Magna Carta was quite an interesting bit of human rights leadership, and it's provided an opportunity for some human rights leadership by the UK over the centuries. But it's an opportunity which hasn't really ever been taken by the UK, and it continues to be rather torn in terms of the approach that the UK wishes to take in its foreign policy in relation to human rights. It aspires to show human rights leadership and part of the global Britain aspiration, but actually is deeply, deeply conflicted about how it does that and the reasons why it's doing that. Now, I don't know whether many of you know about this, but in fact, just after the war in 1947, there was an attempt to make, or there was a discussion within the government about whether the 15th of June should actually be made Magna Carta Day, and specifically for the purposes of schools celebrating it in Britain, the US, and the then British Empire. This was pre-decolonization, of course. And the reasons that the idea was dismissed pretty summarily within the Foreign Office are really quite interesting. There's a possibility that the celebration of Magna Carta Day in the colonial empire might be used for purposes very different from those which we desire. In some colonies, where ill-disposed politicians are ever on the lookout for opportunities to misrepresent our good intentions, its celebration might well cause embarrassment. And in general, there is a danger that the colonial peoples might be led into an uncritical enthusiasm for a document which they had not read, but which they presumed to contain guarantees of every so-called right they might be interested at the moment in claiming. So that was 1947, 75 years ago. Now, of course, Foreign Office communications are a little bit more subtle these days, but I think we can see some undertones in the sentiments underpinning this rejection of the idea of having a Magna Carta Day in the UK's position today in relation to human rights. So I thought that was quite interesting on this particular date, an interesting reflection. So to move on to how Scottish human rights leadership looks from down here, from Westminster. Now, I really want to just frame this in the context of the two different directions of travel on our respective human rights journey, which is really couldn't be more contrasting between the leadership being shown in Scotland and by Scotland and the backsliding which is going on at UK level and down here at Westminster. We only need contrast recent developments in Scotland, the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child Incorporation Bill, set back as it has been by the Supreme Court's ruling, but now hopefully back on track with its reintroduction, the exciting new human rights framework. And as Naomi mentioned, I do have the benefit of a little bit of an insider perspective, having been an independent member of the National Task Force in relation to the human rights framework, which I think is potentially a hugely significant step that Scotland could take in the next couple of years. The contrast between that and what's going on at UK level, where we have, of course, Brexit, which needs no further discussion. We're all very familiar with it, but it's not going away. We have a general retreat from internationalism and international law, and all this at the moment very much focused on the repeal of the Human Rights Act and its replacement by a so-called Bill of Rights, which, as Naomi said in the introduction, is today a very, very much in the news following the European Court's decision last night. So I want to start by saying a few words about the UK's retreat from internationalism and international law, because really this week, leaving aside the reaction to yesterday's European Court ruling, we've seen, I think, a new low point in this retreat from international law in the shape of the Northern Ireland Protocol Bill. Now, the bill was introduced on Monday, and it contains provisions which are breathtakingly broad in the extent to which they will essentially rip up most of the significant provisions in the Northern Ireland Protocol to the withdrawal agreements with the EU. And the legal justification which is relied upon in the summary of the government's legal position is, let's say, tenuous, I think, at best. It relies on Article 25 of the International Law Commission's draft articles on state responsibility and an argument of necessity. And that argument is an argument which should only be resorted to in international law to not perform international obligations in the most narrow of circumstances, as an absolute last resort when there's no other possibility available and when there's a grave and imminent peril to the interests of the state. And there will be a lot of argument about this over the next few days and weeks, but I think I'm fairly confident in saying it's a legal position which is just not going to withstand scrutiny. That position and under that interpretation of Article 25 is extremely tendentious. The threshold is extremely high. It's very unlikely that it's been met. And there is, of course, a specific provision, Article 16, in the Northern Ireland Protocol, which provides for emergency measures to be taken. And in those circumstances, necessity as a matter of international law doctrine can't be resorted to under Article 25. So the Northern Ireland Protocol Bill, I think, is really a new low point, really, in marking the UK's retreat from internationalism and from international law generally. And it's been preceded by a number of bills, some of them now acts, in which, again, this approach to international law is really quite in stark contrast to the UK's traditional reputation for upholding international law and promoting the importance of an international rules-based order. So the UK Internal Market Bill, the precursor to the Northern Ireland Protocol Bill, contained an express provision which was on its face probably in breach of international law, or at the very least provided ministerial powers to breach international law. The Nationality and Borders Act contains provisions which on their face breach the Refugee Convention, and the parliamentary debate and discussion of that bill focused very much on whether or not the provisions were in breach of the Refugee Convention. The overwhelming view of informed commentators and advisers is that the provisions do breach the Refugee Convention. The difficulty, of course, is that the Refugee Convention doesn't have an international court which interprets and enforces it, and therefore we're in the territory of the government asserting that what they're doing is compatible with the Refugee Convention, and it being difficult for domestic courts to actually determine that question, although it will probably become an issue in the judicial review that will be heard in July. I've a couple of other bills just mentioned there, but I won't, in the interest of time, dwell upon them. The Overseas Operations Bill, the Northern Ireland Troubles Legacy Bill, both of these bills in which provisions controversially appear to be incompatible with international legal obligations. So there's a very distinct trend and a quite marked now, I think, indication that the government doesn't really have the same approach to wanting to be seen to be acting compatibly with the UK's international legal obligations and taking a leadership role in upholding that sort of that approach to international law as being important to the international order. And finally, I mentioned briefly the Bill of Rights proposals. I'll come onto this in a moment. But again, there's a provision in the consultation paper, and if this does appear in the bill itself, which will very directly cause difficulties with the UK's compliance with Article 46 of the Convention, the article which requires states to implement judgments against them, because there's a proposal which will undoubtedly lead to standoffs with the European Court, which are likely to breach that important article in the European Convention. So we have this general retreat from international obligations, and in that context, we are waiting for the bill which will repeal the Human Rights Act. And obviously this is the one probably of most direct relevance and concern to us all here this morning. And the history you will all be very familiar with, the Independent Human Rights Act Review, which was set up by the former Lord Chancellor Robert Buckland, conducted a very extensive evidence gathering exercise, held a lot of hearings around the country, established an evidence base, and came up with some fairly measured conclusions that generally speaking, the Human Rights Act is working pretty well. And there may be scope for some tweaks here and there. There may be some amendments that could be made to the Human Rights Act to improve its operation. But broadly speaking, it's working well. And the main problem is disseminating understanding, broadening understanding of exactly what it does and how it upholds people's rights, and trying to get more public ownership of the rights which the Human Rights Act protects, and to get them more embedded in people's consciousness. The consultation paper, which was published in December, bears no relation to the Peter Gross Review, the Independent Human Rights Act Review, and is really quite a different proposition, and contains a number of critiques of the Human Rights Act, and I've given some examples here of some of the assertions, in a general narrative which is extremely hostile to the idea of the Human Rights Act. And examples from that narrative, it asserts that there's been a judicial expansion of rights, that court judgments on Human Rights Act issues frequently defy common sense, that the Act has had the effect of sidelining Parliament and elected politicians and is therefore anti-democratic, that the rights in the Human Rights Act are often abused by unworthy claimants such as foreign national offenders, prisoners, illegal migrants, and that positive obligations which the ECHR imposes on public bodies such as the police are onerous and get in the way of them making decisions, common sense decisions about how they should spend their resources. So it's a very hostile narrative in the consultation paper, and we're all holding our breath to see what's going to be in the bill, which is, we think, probably now quite imminent. And I think just to relate back to Naomi's initial comments, following yesterday's European Court of Human Rights interim measures in relation to the Rwanda flight, there will undoubtedly now be a very concerted campaign. And in fact, I think we can already see on the front pages of today's tabloids the bonfire being stoked for the Human Rights Act to be repealed in the bill which is brought forward. So briefly, in terms of the Bill of Rights, or the so-called Bill of Rights, which is going to be brought forward, insofar as we can tell, obviously this is prior to the bill being published, but if the consultation paper proposals are followed through on, there are some extraordinarily broad indications about what this Bill of Rights is going to do. It's going to decouple the rights which will remain in UK law from convention rights. So the language of the convention rights will remain in UK law, but they will be decoupled from the convention, including the Strasbourg Court's interpretation of the convention rights. There'll be a removal of the obligation to take into account ECHR case law on courts and probably on decision makers. The current interpretive obligation in section 3 is likely to be removed. Positive obligations, that dimension of rights which is so important and which I think on which I think Scotland is showing extraordinary leadership, is said in the consultation paper, going to be removed. Now, it remains to be seen how that's going to be done, but it is an important part of the philosophical approach in the consultation paper. The current Secretary of State does not believe that rights have a positive dimension which impose obligations on public bodies and is opposed in principle to such positive obligations. The proposals suggest that the rights that will remain in the Bill of Rights, the so-called Bill of Rights, are going to be more difficult to enforce by the introduction of various procedural obstacles. So there will be a downgrading of access to justice in relation to the rights. The level of rights protection is going to be made contingent on the conduct of the claimants. So the less worthy individuals that are the often the bête noire of those who believe in this narrative against the Human Rights Act will have a lesser level of protection for their rights under the Bill of Rights. And finally, there's a proposal to introduce a democratic shield, so-called, in the consultation paper against adverse Strasbourg judgments. And the implications of this, I think, really need to be taken on board fully. It's proposed that there will be an institutionalisation of a mechanism which will enable the government to put before the House of Commons, shortly after an adverse Strasbourg judgment, a motion which will essentially say to the Commons, should we follow this or not? Should we implement this or not? And we can imagine if that were in place this morning, that motion would, on the Real 39 interim measures, would probably be on the order paper and debated in the Commons as an urgent matter this morning. And we can see exactly where that's going to lead. It's institutionalising what happened in Hearst at the instance of some backbenchers, where a motion was put essentially asking the Commons, who should decide prisoner voting? Should it be us, the Commons, or should it be this interfering foreign court? So this democratic shield proposal is going to institutionalise that in our arrangements and will undoubtedly lead, in cases which are unpopular with the government, to a standoff with the Strasbourg court and, over time, undoubtedly breaches of the Article 46 obligation to implement judgments. So overall, there's no doubt that this is not at all a Bill of Rights. It doesn't meet the general criteria of what counts as a Bill of Rights in terms of actual legal protection for fundamental rights, which have some degree of protection greater than just being contained in a statute. And as Adam Wagner memorably said, it'll be the only Bill of Rights in history which has been introduced to actually lessen the rights that are protected. So it's a bill of less rights, which we're expecting to be introduced. So that's the context from which we view in Westminster Scotland's proposed human rights framework and the leadership that's being shown in Scotland. And I've just pulled out here some of the elements of the proposed human rights framework, which from the perspective I've just outlined, do look like nirvana from Westminster. So just briefly to identify some of those features, the process which has been conducted to get to this point has been, in my view, an exceptionally inclusive process. It's been a very good example in practice over a long period of time of how constitutional change and constitutional reform around bills of rights and human rights protections ought to be conducted. It's been patient, it's been inclusive, and the contrast between that process and the so-called Bill of Rights that's going to be introduced here in any week now could not be starker. The second feature is the range of rights protected. The inclusion of economic, social, cultural and environmental rights, the approach to these being indivisible, which underpins the proposals, is a truly modern Bill of Rights. Again, as contrasted with the UK government's proposals, which they also call a modern Bill of Rights, which has no truck whatsoever with any of those sorts of rights, as well as hollowing out the approach to civil and political rights. The other feature is another of the features is the internationalist approach and the maximalist approach. So the aspiration to incorporate the rights in the UN human rights treaties that haven't yet been incorporated to the maximum possible extent, and to try to do that in a way which gives real practical effects at the Scottish level to the substance of these rights in a meaningful way which changes people's lives. I think that aspiration is genuine internationalism, and again is a great contrast to the trajectory that's currently going on at UK level. The embedding of a commitment to progressive realisation, again, a really important feature, and my involvement in the task force really revealed to me the extent to which it's understood how that needs to be done. It can't just be a vague declaration of progressive realisation. That needs to be embedded, it needs to be made real. There needs to be mechanisms, processes, machinery in public authorities for making sure that there is actually that direction of travel, and that's literally baked into the design of the whole scheme. The multi-institutional and collaborative approach, which is already being taken in Scotland through the Scottish National Action Plan, but which is also central to the recommendations of the task force, very much to be applauded and admired from the perspective down here. The centrality of monitoring and reporting and the importance of that, the constant evaluation, the constant commitment to improvement absolutely has to be built into any meaningful legal framework for human rights. The importance of access to justice being acknowledged, again, the contrast to what I've described here. The centrality of people with lived experience in the whole scheme, the importance of involving them, and the significance of their perspectives on being the victims of rights violations or simply not having the benefit of rights which exist on paper. Again, an absolutely crucial feature of the framework. And finally, the acknowledgement that resources are absolutely crucial. That the human rights framework isn't just an abstract legal framework on paper, it's also got to translate into commitment of resources to the protection of human rights, and therefore budget setting is also an important human rights issue. Okay, so that's my selection of the features of Scottish human rights leadership, which I think really stand out to an outsider such as myself. And I just want to finish by briefly then moving to see how it looks from Europe and then onto the UN. So viewed from a European perspective, the current president of the European Court of Human Rights, Robert Spano, has talked of this being the age of subsidiarity in the European Convention system. Now, he means subsidiarity in the correct sense that what the convention does is to impose duties on states to make sure that there's adequate protection in their national legal system for the convention rights. And that then to the extent that that isn't successfully achieved at the national level, the court itself has to get involved. Now, subsidiarity is often misunderstood and invoked often by critics of the Human Rights Act in the wrong sense that it means the European Court of Human Rights and the convention system are subordinate to or secondary to the national system. But actually it means that the national system has to take human rights seriously and actually has to embed them in a meaningful way into its national legal systems. And that is exactly what the proposed Human Rights Bill in Scotland is going to do. It's subsidiarity in action in a meaningful sense. And it's the genuine proper sense of which subsidiarity is used in the Council of Europe's convention and whole human rights system. So it fits very well with that current age of subsidiarity and will be an exemplar of subsidiarity in action. It's also worth noting that post Russia's exclusion from the Council of Europe, there's a moment or an opportunity for the Council of Europe, and this is beginning to be to become real, to consider exactly what it's for. There's going to be a reflection on the human rights leadership with the Council, which the Council of Europe itself provides, now that the lowest common denominator has been excluded from the organisation. There is an opportunity for states to come together and to consider what more can the Council of Europe do to actually be a much more proactive human rights promoting organisation, and how could it embed those more effectively in its member states. There's going to be a lot of reflection on that over the next period. The Council of Europe needs leadership, and it needs examples of leadership to be able to do that. The UK is clearly not going to be able to provide that. It's bringing forward a bill which is going to undermine the court. So again, Scottish human rights leadership, I think, is going to be very important for that process. Also, the European institutions, the Council of Europe institutions, often signal the importance of strong human rights institutions. So the importance of strengthening the Scottish Human Rights Commission is going to continue to be a relevant matter for discussion. It also champions having democratic human rights machinery, such as parliamentary human rights committees. So the Scottish Parliament's Human Rights Committee is also going to be an important part of the coming discussion about its place under the new legal framework. And also the importance of the role of civil society, with which you will all be very familiar and are much more expert than me, but that is going to be an incredibly important part of the coming discussion about the new legal framework in Scotland. And from the European point of view, again, something of great interest to Europe, and Europe also looking for some very good examples to be able to hold up for others to follow. Very quickly, to look at the view from the rest of the world or from the UN, we've got the UN Secretary General's 2020 call to action for human rights, and many of the things which the Secretary General was calling for are embodied in the proposals for the new Scottish human rights framework, an approach to human rights which accepts their indivisibility, an important emphasis on prevention being better than cure, not a choice between the two, but a new shift in focus to prevention, and the development of human rights-based approaches to a number of policy areas, broadening out human rights-based approaches to policy and demonstrating how they lead to better policy outcomes. At UN level, there's also, of course, the Build Back Better After COVID aspiration. It's important to mention this because after the pandemic, I think it has really reframed the human rights discussion and discourse internationally. It hasn't at UK level yet, but it has done internationally. And I think there is now a greater awareness of the importance of security, of the role of the state in actually providing financial security, the importance of the state in actually protecting people's health, and generally showing the importance of positive obligations in all those rights with which we're very familiar. So again, that's very much an open door to demonstrate how the Scottish proposals are meaningfully doing that and playing into international discussions about how to do that in a meaningful way. There are some UN draft principles on parliaments and human rights, which focus on the role of parliaments as actors in protecting human rights as part of a multi-institutional collaborative approach to human rights protection. And again, the role of the Scottish Parliament's Human Rights Committee in living up to those principles, which it's declared it wishes to do, will, I think, be an important part of the ongoing discussion. There are UN recommendations on NMIRF's National Mechanisms for Implementation, Reporting and Follow-up. And again, Scotland's approach and multi-institutional approach will develop from SNAP, which is already a good starting point, under the new framework in ways which I think will contain some important lessons for the UN as it develops its approach to NMIRFs. And of course, there's also a new awareness post-COP26, although that now seems a long time ago, of the importance of environmental rights receiving constitutional protection. And again, that's in that respect, Scotland's new framework will be pioneering internationally. So just finally, some thoughts really in terms of opportunities. There seems to me there's an exciting number of opportunities. We're very used to boosterism in London, and lots of references to things being world leading, and we take it all with a pinch of salt these days. But there is, I think, real potential for the Scottish legal human rights framework that's being considered to be genuinely world leading. If it focuses, as it proposes to do, on how legal protection for human rights actually improves people's lives, the practical ways in which it improves people's lives in concrete ways, ordinary people's lives, and focuses on measuring, evaluating, demonstrating exactly how that is done, that is a huge opportunity to demonstrate to the world how legal rights frameworks actually matter to people. And that's the nut that has never been cracked at UK level, as we're about to see very painfully in the coming weeks. I've mentioned making Build Back Better after COVID meaningful. I think there's a huge opportunity here to situate the Scottish debate on the human rights framework in that broader international context, where the international community, again, is going to be looking for examples of how to do that. So my sort of concluding remarks really are to encourage you all. I know you will be doing this anyway, but there are so many opportunities which we in London look at with great envy. get involved in the consultation on Scotland's Human Rights Bill when it comes. Active involvement in that will be sought by the government and is so important to develop and improve the proposals that will be brought forward. Please get engaged on the UK level debate about human rights repeal and the Bill of Rights proposals, because the clouds are darkening in that respect. Get involved in the coming debate about the future of the European human rights system post-Russia's exclusion and post-Ukraine, because that's also a debate which is now gathering momentum. And finally, continue to be involved in all the international monitoring that the UN does, which involves Scotland. So I greatly applaud the consortium's engagement with the UPR process. It's a great submission, and it's really important, I think, to engage with all those monitoring mechanisms. So apologies for going a few minutes over. Back to you, Naomi.
Thank you for listening to the Human Rights 2020s podcast. For more information about our work as Scotland's civil society network for the protection and promotion of human rights, please visit our website at www.hrcscotland.org or follow us on Twitter at @hrcscotland. Thank you.